All right, a happy, happy birthday to a lot of folks today. Let's see, we want to wish Janice Block of Sheffield, Iowa, happy birthday. Kathleen Igu of Calumet or Cherokee also has a birthday today. Larry Paxson of Fort Dodge, happy birthday to you. Michael Satry of Cedar Rapids and Shireen Williams of Colfax, all of you share a birthday today on February 20th. It's a great day for a birthday. You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. If you're hearing us on your television on Iowa PBS and you're not a registered IRIS user, please give us a call at 515-243-6833 so we can get you on our list. We do want to know who is listening, and so we have you on our list, and we just want to do that in order to keep our services free. And I do believe we have a couple of obituaries today. So, Deanna, oh, we have one today? Okay. If you want to read that one obituary, here's Deanna.
Thank you, Nicole. Yes, the only obituary is for Larry Aaron Kahn, C-O-N-N, out of Pleasantville. Larry Aaron Kahn, aged 88, died Thursday, February 15th at Wesleyan Grand in Des Moines. A funeral service will be held Thursday, February 22nd at 2 o'clock at the Wakanda Christian Church. Visitation with refreshments will be served 1 hour prior to the service. Burial will be in Pleasantville Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the Wakanda Christian Church or the Pleasantville Christian Church. Mason Funeral Home in Pleasantville is handling arrangements, and online condolences may be left at thebertrandfuneralhomes.com. Larry was a music teacher at Twin Cedars Community School for 15 years. From 1972 until 1982, Larry was division manager of personnel at the Federal Reserve Bank, the Des Moines office. In 1982, he became the director of the Webb Shadle Memorial Library, located in Pleasantville, and retired after 32 years. Larry was organist and pianist and served several Des Moines churches, and in particular, the Wakanda Christian Church, where he was a member and served as organist for 43 years. And I think I'll go ahead with two brief articles in the main section. The first one on page 5. How to check for your Iowa and federal tax refunds. You can track on websites or by phone. This is from Victoria Reyna Rodriguez. We're in the thick of tax season. If you've already filed your taxes, you might be wondering, when should you get your tax refunds and how do you check its status? Iowa has its own Where's My Refund tool on tax.iowa.gov to check the status of individual income tax returns and amended individual income tax returns that you've filed in the last year. You will need to know your Social Security number and the amount of your refund. It can take up to a week after filing your return electronically for tracking information to appear on the state's tool. Iowans can also get information by calling 1-800-367-3388. The representatives will not have any additional information than what's on the website, according to the Department of Revenue. Iowa's goal is to process refunds within 30 days, said the website. So where is my IRS tax refund? You can check your federal tax refund status through the Where's My Refund tool on the Internal Revenue Service's website. Visit irs.gov/refunds or use the IRS To Go mobile app to see the latest information on your tax return and refund. You can also get information on your tax year 2022 or 2021 refunds. You can begin checking 24 hours after e-filing a tax year 2023 return, 4 weeks after mailing a paper return. Data are updated once per day, usually at night, so there's no need to check more often, according to the IRS. Refunds are usually issued within 21 days. And then there's a brief article on page 7. Nikki Haley says, Congress is lying on the border aid measure. This is from Marina Potofsky. Former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley on Sunday accused Congress of lying to the American people as lawmakers fail to pass long-awaited legislation addressing the U.S.-Mexico border and aid to Israel, Ukraine, and other American allies. A bipartisan group of senators spent months crafting a deal that would have married border priorities, and foreign assistance. However, swaths of Republicans recently rejected the agreement, along with separate Senate-passed legislation on foreign aid. While the House did pass a hardline border bill last year, dubbed H.R. 2, it has no chance of passing in the Senate, which is controlled by Democrats. When asked about the efforts on ABC's This Week, Haley said, "Congress needs to do their job and make sure they go and do everything they can for national security. Congress is failing because they are making this sound like you have to choose between Ukraine and Israel or securing the border," Haley said. "They are lying to the American people. That's a false premise. We can do both." Republican lawmakers have largely called for immigration legislation and foreign assistance to be tied together. It's not clear whether lawmakers will make any progress on the goal this week, with both House and Senate lawmakers traveling back to their home districts for a recess. Haley on Sunday also called on President Joe Biden to go further in talking about the importance of foreign aid with Americans across the country. She said Joe Biden needs to be speaking more to the American people about what this package means and why it affects the American people and why it protects them from further war, she said. Republican presidential candidate is gearing up to compete with former President Donald Trump in South Carolina's pivotal Republican primary on Saturday. During her Sunday interview, Haley declined to say whether she would support Trump if he does receive the 2024 GOP nomination. She said, "I'm going to run and I'm going to win. And y'all can talk about support, right? Right now you can ask him if he's going to support me when I'm the nominee," Haley said. Nicole.
All right, and this next article is actually from the online edition of the Des Moines Register that was published today. It's in the health section. HPV vaccines save lives, study show. So why are so many Iowa children not getting shots? This is from Michaela Ram of the Des Moines Register. Nearly two decades since the vaccine against HPV first arrived in Iowa, local public officials in parts of the state say they still struggle to persuade residents to vaccinate their children. In 2023, about 56% of the state's 13 to 15-year-olds were fully vaccinated against the human papillomavirus, a sexually transmitted infection that is linked to deadly cancers. That includes certain type of cancers that are prevalent here in Iowa. The new data from the Iowa Department of Health and Human Services shows last year's immunization rates are in line with recent years. The HPV vaccination rate among adolescent Iowans had fallen slightly from 57% in 2022 and from nearly 58% in 2021. That compares to nearly 59% in 2020 and 44.5% in 2019. However, the state's public health data paints a starker picture in portions of southeast and eastern Iowa, where the HPV immunization rate falls below 30%. Local public health officials in those areas say they have long struggled to make progress on that vaccination rate, pointing to stigma and misinformation about the vaccine as a significant factor. Health experts warn that HPV can spread easily in areas with low immunization rates, which in turn increases the risk for nearby counties, even those with higher vaccine uptake. That's an alarming possibility for health experts, who say a lack of protection against HPV increases the risk more Iowans could be exposed to deadly cancer-causing viral strains. Dr. Nathan Boonstra, a Des Moines-based pediatrician and chair of the Iowa Immunizes Coalition, says down the road, those cancers lead to a lot of deaths, and they're going to lead to a lot of deaths of Iowans. Anything we can do to increase those vaccination rates is important. Van Buren County had the lowest HPV immunization rate in Iowa last year, with just 23% of its 13 to 15-year-olds fully vaccinated. That's a drop from 37.5% in 2020. Lindy Thomas, public health administrator for Van Buren County, says that in our county, it has not been well accepted. Thomas says the county has a large Amish and Mennonite population who have universally turned down the shots for their children. But even outside that population, parents typically decline the two-series vaccine, saying that they believe their children aren't old enough for a vaccine that protects against a sexually transmitted virus. Thomas says, "It's been a conversation for years. We've always had issues with that one. When it first came out, I think it was promoted as more of a sexual vaccine instead of a cancer-preventing vaccine. And I think that has stuck with that vaccine." The vaccine is recommended to girls and boys at 11 and 12 years to prevent serious health problems that's caused by HPV, which is the most common sexually transmitted infection in the United States. While most infections do clear up on their own, HPV infections in some cases can cause certain types of cancer, including cervical, vulvar, vaginal, anal, penile, and it just says your throat, but the technical term is some other word. Anyway, Boonser says it inherently gets stigmatized. That's really too bad because most people who are sexually active in their lives will contract at least one type of HPV. That is pretty universal. Boonser says the vaccine is recommended to adolescents because the shots have been found to be more effective against HPV infection if the vaccine is administered before that individual is exposed to the virus. The 2023 Cancer in Iowa report by researchers at the University of Iowa found that Iowa ranks first in the country for cancer in the oral cavity and also the pharynx. HPV is one of the leading causes of cancer in the throat, particularly among men. In fact, HPV-related cancers kill more people every year than polio, measles, tetanus, and chickenpox combined before vaccines for these diseases were developed. Michelle Cullen, public health manager for Jackson and Clinton counties, said that Jackson County lacks many primary healthcare providers that can offer these immunizations. She believes that is a major contributing factor to other rural counties. To encourage residents to seek out the shots, Cullen says that her public health staff have tried multiple ways to raise awareness about the importance of these shots. They send students home with packets of information for their parents. Their nurses adjust hours at the county immunization clinic to expand appointment hours. But despite this, Jackson County's immunization rate among its 13 to 15-year-olds was just 26% in 2023, one of the lowest rates in the state. That compares to 31% in 2020. Clinton County's immunization rate was nearly 37% in 2023. Cullen says, "We've done outreach, we've done awareness and education, but we have not seemed to move the needle very much." Now, since the HPV vaccine was first recommended by federal health officials in 2006, infection of HPV strains that cause cancers and genital warts have fallen. According to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, 88% among teen girls and 81% among young adult women. Boonstra says the HPV vaccine is one of the most life-saving vaccines that we have. It's demonstrated to drastically reduce certain kinds of cancer, especially cervical cancer, but also head and neck cancers. But because of the stigma and because it is a relatively new vaccine, Boonstra says HPV has become a, quote, easy target for anti-vaccine movements that have eroded confidence in these shots. In recent years, several bills have been introduced to the Iowa legislature that raise concerns to public advocates like those at the Iowa Immunizes Coalition. That includes a bill being considered by lawmakers this session that would revoke a minor's right to consent to the HPV vaccine. Senate filed 2064 passed a committee vote last week, making it eligible for Senate debate. Boonstra says if that bill goes into effect, the provision likely wouldn't affect immunization rates here in the state. But still, he says that legislation chip away at the margins. Boonstra says, "I really do think that our legislators know that vaccines are important. I think they know that HPV vaccine is important. Some may need to learn more about the importance of adolescents being able to make some of their healthcare decisions as they reach a certain age." The Iowa Immunizes Coalition do continue to watch this type of legislation closely and also on factors that could impact Iowa's immunization rate. "We want kids to grow up healthy," Boonstra says. "We want to reduce risk of factor as much as possible, and an adolescent who doesn't have that vaccine is going to be at higher risk of a number of cancers. Deanna, you have another story for us? All right, over to you.
Thank you, Nicole. This is on page 4 of the main section. Palestinians seek an end to occupation. An official tells top UN court Israel guilty of apartheid. This is from John Bacon of the USA Today. I'll do my best to pronounce some of these names. Israel's occupation of the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem denies Palestinians the right of self-determination, is illegal, and must be brought to an immediate, unconditional, and total end, said the Palestinian foreign minister to the UN's top court Monday. His name is Riyad al-Maliki. He told the International Court of Justice in The Hague that Palestinians have endured colonialism and apartheid since the occupation began in 1967. Now the world must finally cut off support to Israel, he said. No aid, no assistance, no complicity, no contribution to forcible actions, no money, no arms, no trade. This is what the Palestinian foreign minister said. Member states are obliged by law to end Israel's presence on the territory of Palestine. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu issued a statement saying Israel does not recognize the legitimacy of the proceedings, which he described as an effort to infringe on Israel's right to defend itself against existential threats. The UN General Assembly asked the court for an advisory opinion on the Israeli 57-year occupation and refusal to comply with overwhelming global support for a two-state solution. Netanyahu's government argues it must retain control of security over the territories because Palestinian political leaders have vowed to destroy Israel. Netanyahu points to the October 7th attack on Israel by Hamas-led militants who killed 1,200 people and seized more than 250 hostages before retreating back to Gaza. The Palestinian foreign minister accused Israel of denying Gaza residents desperately needed humanitarian aid, with a false claim that the aid was supporting Hamas. Al-Maliki told the court, Israel has transformed the Gaza Strip into an impoverished enclave, a strangled, besieged, bombarded community, isolated and severed from the West Bank and East Jerusalem. He told the court, its leaders have declared that Israel will be sovereign over all the land between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea and made this formal government policy. More than 50 countries are expected to testify during the week-long hearing. Israel likely will provide a written rebuttal. Judges could take months to issue the non-binding opinion. So here are two recent developments. Israeli Foreign Minister Israel Katz declared Brazilian President Luiz Lula da Silva persona non grata in Israel until he apologizes for accusing Israel of genocide and comparing its actions to Adolf Hitler's campaign to exterminate Jewish people. Hamas issued a statement thanking da Silva for his accurate description of what our people are exposed to and revealing the enormity of Israel's crimes in Gaza. The other recent development, Houthi rebels said they shot down a U.S. drone and that a cargo ship they attacked in the Gulf of Aden appeared ready to sink. U.S. Central Command did not immediately respond to a USA Today request for comment on the drone. The U.K.'s maritime trade confirmed that the crew of the Rubemar had abandoned ship and said military authorities were providing assistance. Netanyahu dismissed Palestinian demands that Israel relinquish control of Gaza, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem, territories essentially occupied by Israel since the Arab-Israeli War fought in 1967. Netanyahu described the court proceedings underway in The Hague as a Palestinian attempt to dictate a diplomatic settlement without negotiations. Netanyahu said, "We will continue to reject this." Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich reiterated his opposition to a Palestinian state. Speaking at the Knesset meeting of his far-right religious Zionism faction, he said he will not consecrate a Palestinian terror entity with the blood of our soldiers. The UN General Assembly voted in December of 2022 to seek the court's opinion on the legal consequences of the occupation. The U.S. and Israel were among 27 nations that voted against the hearing. This case is separate from another case pressed by South Africa, accusing Israel of committing genocide in Gaza since the war began in October 7th. In that case, the court ordered Israel to prevent and punish incitement to genocide and to provide needed humanitarian aid by February 26th. The Hamas official said Monday that 6,000 of its fighters have died in the war, about half the number Israel claims to have killed. The officials who spoke to Reuters on condition of anonymity said Hamas remains prepared for a long war. Also Monday, the Hamas-run health ministry in Gaza reported that 29,000 Palestinians have been killed and 69,000 have been wounded since the war began. The ministry numbers don't differentiate between combatants and civilians, but the ministry says more than 70% of the casualties are women and children. Israel announced the death of Staff Sergeant Simon Shlomov, age 20, raising its military death toll since the war began to 235. Qatar's prime minister criticized Netanyahu for asking Qatari officials to pressure Hamas into freeing Israeli hostages. Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdul Rahman Al Thani added that talks toward a ceasefire and long-term peace deal were not very promising. Qatar, Egypt, and the U.S. have spearheaded the talks, and authorities in the three nations have generally kept public comments on the talks positive. But on Monday, Qatar's foreign ministry spokesman, Majed al-Ansari, described Netanyahu's request as nothing but a new attempt by him to delay and prolong the war for reasons that have become clear to everyone. Al-Ansari accused Netanyahu of acting solely for the purpose of escaping his personal political crises in Israel. We ask him to focus on the course of negotiations in a way that serves the security of the region and ends the ongoing tragedy of continuing war, instead of issuing such statements whenever that suits his narrow political agenda. Nicole, back to you.
And now we turn to 50 states. I'll start with the Midwest states, and then Deanna can wrap up with whatever she wants. All right, Illinois, Springfield, Illinois. Paul Powell, the Southern Illinois political powerhouse who died and left behind $800,000 in cash in the notorious shoebox scandal, used to say the only thing worse than a defeated politician is a broke one. For more than half a century, a Powell-established $250,000 trust sustained his legacy, for better or worse, but the account that maintained his birthplace as a museum will soon run dry. The fate of the home in Vienna is uncertain, but it likely will be sold. Indianapolis, Indiana, the earth may be warming at an even faster rate than expected, escalating the threat from climate change, according to a new study by a research team that included an Indiana State University professor. Right here in Des Moines, Iowa, Iowa's smallest and largest farms have proliferated over the past 20 years, while the number of those in the middle is shrinking. This is according to the latest U.S. Census of Agriculture. Farms of fewer than 180 acres have increased nearly 12% over the past two decades, according to the census, a comprehensive farm survey that the U.S. Department of Agriculture conducts every 5 years. Experts say that's because farmers are scaling down in the face of record-high land prices and also escalating expenses for seed, fertilizer, tractors, and other equipment and products. Topeka, Kansas. Kansas lawmakers are considering a likely ill-fated move to ask permission from the federal government to ban purchases of candy and soda using food stamps. Lansing, Michigan. Three newborn North American River otters are the newest addition to the Potter Park Zoo. This is the mom's Nikkei's fourth litter and second set of triplets. In St. Paul, Minnesota, a Minnesota high school teacher of students with developmental and cognitive disabilities was arrested on criminal sexual misconduct charges for allegedly having sex with a former student, according to several outlets. In Columbia, Missouri, the University of Missouri is paying attention to artificial intelligence, the director of the MU Office of Academic Integrity says. An AI task force is being formed to look at how faculty uses AI to teach and also what students should be learning about AI or AI literacy. To Omaha, Nebraska, rescue groups are seeking donations after 18 cats were found at an abandoned trailer home. And to Bismarck, North Dakota, the state's top regulator says that oil production dipped in December, but natural gas production hit another record. To Columbus, Ohio, magic mushrooms being studied by researchers at Ohio State University could unlock new treatments for mental illnesses within the next few years. Both psilocybin, the naturally occurring psychedelic component of magic mushrooms, and a synthetic version of it, have been coupled in with intensive therapy and are in clinical trials at Ohio State. This is according to the director of the school's Center for Psychedelic Drug Research and Education. Got a couple more, three more in the Midwest, and then we'll turn things over to Deanna. Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Some Oklahoma lawmakers want to bring the state off the sidelines of sports betting and into the game. They're facing long odds, however. Governor Kevin Stitt wants to open Oklahoma's betting market to outside competitors. Tribal officials say that doing so would violate their gaming agreement with the state. But without a consensus, efforts to legalize sports betting appear unlikely to gain traction during the legislative session this spring. Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Sioux Falls school district officials won't be releasing the list of possible school names that they've received from community members just yet. This is for the new elementary school to be built on the northwest side of the city by George McGovern Middle School. And finally, the Midwest 50 States Roundup. Milwaukee, Wisconsin. A collection of Milwaukee elected officials are once again calling on the state legislature to allow for the city to use automated traffic enforcement cameras to cite drivers who run red lights in another effort to reduce reckless driving. Milwaukee officials didn't offer many more details of what kind of automatic traffic cameras program that they want.
Thank you, Nicole. And this just blows me away. Out of Jackson, Wyoming, officials said a man has died after colliding with a snowplow. Oh, dear. That's just terrible. Okay, I'm going to start alphabetically here. Alabama, Tuscaloosa. Students at Taylorville Primary School crowded around a new vending machine, but this machine is different than other vending machines, which typically dispense snacks and drinks. The new machine dispenses books. Taylorville Primary unveiled the machine in the school library by cutting a golden ribbon that was wrapped around the machine. Principal Lori Presley said the machine is a way to reward students and to promote reading. Out of Anchorage, Alaska, an Alaska woman hoping to cash in after a man offered her $9 million in an online murder-for-hire plot has been sentenced to 99 years in prison for orchestrating the fatal shooting of her friend, state officials said. From Phoenix, Arizona, a bipartisan bill that cleared a Senate committee last week would spawn a medical psilocybin mushroom industry in Arizona that could grow into a larger market in the future. From Fayetteville, Arkansas, officers said a woman was arrested after one dog and 34 cats were found neglected in her home, according to the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. From Berkeley, California, the 19-year-old son of a former YouTube executive died last week at the UC Berkeley campus where he resided, said officials and a relative. Out of Fort Collins, Colorado, Poudre School District removed many of the drinking fountains and replaced faucets on dozens of classroom sinks in its elementary schools to ensure the amount of lead in water students drink was within the limits allowed under new Colorado law. The classroom drinking fountains are being replaced by hydration stations where students can fill bottles with filtered water, according to PSD's environmental coordinator. Out of Killingly, Connecticut, two dogs were rescued from a house fire in Killingly. The two adults and three children who lived in the house were not home when the fire occurred. From Willington, Delaware, the airport received $5.6 million in federal infrastructure funding to update and expand its terminal, according to an announcement from the Federal Aviation Administration. Out of Washington, D.C., Robert Spano was recently hired to become music director of the Washington National Opera, starting with the 2025-26 season. Evan Rochester, the principal conductor since 2018, will end his role at the conclusion of the 24-25 season. Spano, who's 62, agreed to a 3-year contract and will have the title music director role designate until starting his new role. Keep going. Are we done? Nicole says, we're done.
Not in those words per se, but we are almost done to that halfway point for the last 90 minutes. Your readers have been Deanna Snyder and myself, Nicole Tam. It's been our pleasure to read with you. We love those 50 states at the end. But now it is time for us to take a short break and allow our next set of readers to get in place. We'll see you later.
Welcome back. Your new readers are myself, Scott Splavik, and Doug Kretzinger. We'll continue with articles from the Des Moines Register and USA Today, and here's Doug with our next article.
Thank you, Scott. The opinion page from the USA Today, "Dialysis at Home Should Be Better Utilized," is the heading, written by Amber Pettis and Dr. Uvaram Reddy. And Amber Pettis is a person living with kidney failure and a patient advocate with the National Kidney Foundation. Amber crashed into in-center hemodialysis, switched to home dialysis, and is now living with a kidney transplant. Amber and Uvaram worked together on research projects to identify new ways to improve access to home dialysis for people living with kidney failure, and this is what they have written. In 2014, Amber Pettis felt nauseous and tired. She went to see her doctor because she thought she had a stomach bug. Instead, she learned she had kidney failure, a life-altering disease requiring long-term dialysis or a kidney transplant to survive. In that short visit, Amber's life changed. She crashed into dialysis and had to put her life on hold. Instead of her plan to see the world, she traveled to a dialysis unit three times a week, where she was hooked up to a machine to clean her blood. On the days when she was off dialysis, she felt wiped out and spent the time just trying to recover. Amber's story is common. Over 800,000 Americans live with kidney failure, and half will die within 5 years. While kidney transplantation can help patients live longer, few organs are available, and about 100,000 people are stuck on a transplant wait list. Unfortunately, deep inequities also exist. Black Americans are more likely to develop kidney failure than white Americans and are half as likely to receive a kidney transplant. Home dialysis could have given Amber the flexibility to personalize her treatment and even travel the world. But no one discussed home dialysis with her until months later. Once she discovered the option, she switched to it and felt much better. Nearly a decade later, few patients in the United States get the chance to choose home dialysis. This is disappointing, as home dialysis benefits patients while also being cheaper for the taxpayers who fund Medicare. These advantages are so apparent that 90% of kidney clinicians would choose home dialysis if they needed it. In contrast, only 13% of patients in America receive home dialysis. Advancing American Kidney Health Initiative faces obstacles. To fix this, the federal government issued an executive order in 2019, the Advancing American Kidney Health Initiative, which calls for 80% of new patients with kidney failure to receive home dialysis or get a transplant. But, as Amber's story suggests, that shift faces many obstacles. In-center dialysis has been the default therapy for kidney failure for more than 50 years. Even now, it takes kidney clinicians far more time and effort to arrange for home dialysis. Instead, many patients crash into the hospital with kidney failure and begin in-center dialysis. Some progress has been made. Medicare payment models have attracted new companies such as Somatus, Monogram Health, and Strive Health to innovate. Penn Medicine is working with another startup, Evergreen Nephrology, to provide more patient-centered care, including home dialysis. But many challenges remain. Kidney care is incredibly fragmented. Often, the nephrologist caring for patients before dialysis is different from the one who provides their dialysis or evaluates them for a transplant. These nephrologists often face communication barriers because they work in different systems. Another problem is that many kidney doctors graduate from training without feeling prepared to treat patients on home dialysis. The American Society of Nephrology and other organizations are working to enhance education for trainees. Home Dialysis University, led by Dr. Joel Glickman at the University of Pennsylvania, is one such training resource. And lastly, we face a critical workforce shortage. Few nurses are skilled to provide home dialysis training. The bar of entry to become home dialysis nurses also is arbitrarily high. Legislators should consider ways to ease the requirements for credentialing, improve reimbursement to raise nursing salaries, and allow for more staff to support home dialysis nurses. If we had solved these kidney treatment problems years ago, Amber might have started her journey with home dialysis, in avoiding several painful and costly hospitalizations. Fortunately, she received a kidney transplant in 2015 and is now off dialysis. The Memphis resident is now a patient advocate for the National Kidney Foundation and is an apostle for home dialysis. Amber now shows other patients how to have life. As a patient advocate, Amber now meets with patients to talk about how home dialysis can allow people to have life in the midst of end-stage renal disease, such as it did for her. Not everyone can do home dialysis. Some patients lack dexterity or a clean environment to perform dialysis. Yet these barriers could be overcome by a new system that better supports patients and clinicians. The 2019 executive order created our biggest opportunity to build a better system. The question is, what will it take to achieve it?
Thank you, Doug. Our second opinion article today is written by Rex Hupke, and it's entitled, Trump Sneaks in a New Source of Revenue. It was good to see the 2024 presidential campaign settle into normalcy this weekend as leading Republican candidate Donald Trump took the traditional step of introducing a garish line of sneakers that he can use to whittle down the half a billion or so dollars he owes for fraudulent business practices and other assorted crime doing. In case you missed it, former president and current criminal defendant Trump attended a Philadelphia sneaker con on Saturday and unveiled a shiny gold pair of Trump-themed sneakers called the Never Surrender High Tops. In what one can only assume is an attempt to show how good President Joe Biden's economy is for Americans, the list price for the Trump shoes is $399 a pair, and the 1,000 that were available quickly sold out. On Friday, a New York judge ruled that Trump must pay about $454 million in penalties for business fraud. 3 weeks earlier, a jury ordered Trump to pay more than $83 million to writer E. Jean Carroll for defamation. So the Republican Party's top choice for president is now on the hook for about $540 million. The $399,000... He made $399,000 on that first round of Air Rogant sneakers, so he only needs to sell about 1,352,383 more pairs, and he'll be square. Remarkably, the sneakers look exactly like the kind of sneakers you would expect from a man who created a fake university named after himself and then had to pay $25 million to settle lawsuits accusing him of fraud. The sneakers are, possibly spray-painted, gold, including the laces. They have a big T on them in various places, and they have a sort of American flag thingy wrapped around the ankles. They're the go-to athletic shoe for people fleeing responsibility. They look as if someone took all the tacky couture from a random night at Mar-a-Lago, put it in a blender, and then poured it into a cheap pair of high tops that, in their defense, never did anything to deserve such a fate. The 1,000 pairs sold out is a testament to Trump's ability to extract cash from the gullible. Either that, or MAGA-devout House of Representatives Speaker Mike Johnson bought them all and will now make them the mandatory shoe of the Republican Congressional Caucus. All I know is that it's about time our current presidential election season came down to that which matters most, footwear. I've long cast my vote for whichever candidate promotes the sweetest kicks, and 2024 will be no different. We're way past the days of President Ronald Reagan's special edition jelly bean Reeboks, President Bill Clinton's controversial philandering Fila, or presidential candidate John Kerry's unremarkable Payless flip-flop. It's up to the Biden campaign to respond to Trump's gaffe in sneaker form by showing Americans what the 81-year-old president will do for their feet. I recommend a durable but comfortable line of already broken-in Biden slippers. The motto is simple. You should trust what you put your feet in. Not gold, just old, tough, and cozy. They could give them away for free, as President Biden has the distinct advantage of not owing more than $500 million in legal penalties for fraud and determination. Seems like a shoe-in.
Rex Huxby. Good one. Okay, sports section, Des Moines Register. Final look at state wrestling, and this one is entitled, headline is titled, Freeman Denied History But Stays Upbeat, written by Eli McCown of the Des Moines Register. All week, Waukee Northwest Carter Freeman faced the noise at the Iowa State Wrestling Tournament. Every reporter with a camera and a microphone approached him with 1,000 questions after each match. How are you handling the pressure of potentially being the next four-time state champion? What would it mean to be a four-time state champion? Why was that match so close compared to the others? All four opponents he faced in Des Moines gave him their best shot, too, wanting to be the one to play spoiler. Coaches watched his post-match interviews and old tape to gain an edge based on his prior words and moves. Freeman admitted after his semi-final match that he was going to be relieved when this circus was all over, because win or lose, one thing was always going to happen. Quote, the sun is going to come up tomorrow, end quote. That's a phrase Freeman used often during the weeks leading up to the state tournament. Leading into the finals, where he was facing longtime Seabolt training partner Coy Davidson, Freeman said he felt great. He was ready to have fun. The two traded escapes in the first three periods, with Freeman looking like the aggressor through the match. A couple of times, including in overtime, Freeman looked like he might have connected on the one shot he needed to clinch his fourth. With about 30 seconds left in overtime, the two engaged in an epic scramble. The two locked wraps around one another's waist and began to spin. The difference between history being made and history being stopped would come down to who could topple their good friend over first. Ultimately, it was taller, bigger Davison who flopped Freeman onto his back to be crowned the 138-pound champion in 3A. Right after, Davison tipped his hat to his Seabolt partner. Quote, he made me who I am now, Davison said. We made each other get to the top of the mountain just being practice partners. A lot of credit is due to Carter, and I can't thank him enough, end quote. On the other side of Wells Fargo Arena, in the tunnel, was an emotional Freeman. Being a four-time champion and getting the raucous approval from the wrestling community was something he dreamed of since he was a little kid. Yet, that same saying was still on his mind. Whether that overtime go or went my way or not, I feel like that doesn't change who I am, Freeman said. The saying, the sun will come up tomorrow, means that the world is not going to end tonight because I didn't get that takedown. I've got bigger and better things to accomplish, and I'm forever grateful for this team and the support staff around me, he said. From the beginning of his wrestling career, that is what Freeman has been about. Not the wins and losses, but improving each day as a wrestler. He became one of the state's best wrestlers in recent memory. Not only a three-time champion, but finishing with a 154-6 record with the Wolves and Waukee Warriors in his freshman season. Carter is the kind of guy that's like, okay, that one's done. What are we going to do next? Waukee Northwest coach Chad Vomek said. He continued, continue to get better, continue to keep working, because Carter's end game isn't the state tournament. The state tournament is just another step in Carter's career, end quote. Next step is now Northern Iowa, where he'll wrestle for Coach Doug Schwab and the Panthers. a three-time NCAA All-American, a 1999 NCAA champion, a 2007 U.S. senior freestyle title, among other accomplishments. Schwab won just one state title while at Osage in 1996. In 93 and 95, he placed second. That's a testament to just how hard this tourney can be. Per Freeman, Schwab's message to him after the loss was that this moment will hurt for a long time, but it'll only be fuel for whatever comes next for him. Freeman is already seeing the silver lining ahead as his wrestling career just gets started. Quote, having that moment is something that I'll be grateful for, even though I didn't win, end quote. That's Freeman.
Drake shares first after Sunday's win. It's written by Andrew Loge of the Des Moines Register. Sunday ended with the Drake men's basketball team exactly where coach Darren DeVries hoped it would be, deadlocked atop the Missouri Valley Conference standings. Quote, this is what February is all about, where you want to be in some meaningful games, end quote, DeVries said after a 95-72 rout of Murray State. This is why college basketball is so fun. Kevin Overton and Tucker DeVries scored 23 and 22 points respectively as the Bulldogs earned their 19th straight win at the Knapp Center and proved to a record of 22 wins and 5 losses overall, 13 wins, 3 losses in the Missouri Valley Conference. That moved them into a first-place tie with number 23 Indiana State, which held a 2-game lead in the standings a week ago. Quote, we dug ourselves into a little bit of a hole, Tucker DeVries said. He goes on to say, we knew we didn't control our own destiny to get back into the regular season race, end quote. The Sycamores' 74-69 loss to Southern Illinois on Saturday gave Drake a chance to make up ground. The Bulldogs responded by shooting 60.7% against Murray State, including 56.7% from three-point range. It was the most three-pointers given up by the Racers this season. Quote, they cause a lot of issues, Murray State coach Steve Prohm said. He goes on to say their ability to spread you out, the ball movement, and the pace that they play with offensively. But they also put so much pressure on the basketball and speed you up, end quote. Drake began to dominate the Racers with a 14-0 run late in the first half. The Bulldogs were already up 36-26 despite Tucker DeVries taking some time to warm up. The 6'7" junior did not score until the 8:46 mark of the first half and did not make his second basket until 1 minute 39 seconds left in the half. Quote, I think they did a good job, especially coming off ball screens, DeVries said of the Murray State defenders. He goes on to say they did a good job hedging it and sending two guys a lot of time. I was just sticking with it and letting the game come to me, end quote. DeVries erupted for 7 points in the span of 19 seconds, hitting a three-pointer and layup while being fouled on both attempts. His second free throw pushed the Bulldogs' lead to 43-26. Quote, obviously they feel good when they go in, DeVries said. He goes on to say, good momentum plays, especially with the home crowd. You can feel the energy a little bit, end quote. A three-pointer and two free throws by Overton helped Drake take a 48-29 advantage into halftime. The freshman guard had 12 points before the break. Quote, our energy and our defense allowed the crowd to get into it, Overton said. He goes on to say, just playing off each other, end quote. At and Wright contributed a trio of three-pointers in the first half and finished with 12 points. Overton and Wright combined on consecutive three-pointers in the second half to give the Bulldogs a 68-44 advantage with 12 minutes, 36 seconds left. Drake scored 26 points off turnovers. The Bulldogs also scored 26 points in the paint and held a 28-24 edge in rebounding despite Darnell Brody's early foul trouble. Brody, who scored in double figures in 7 of his past 9 games, accounted for the Bulldogs' first 5 points, but was called for a second foul just over 4 minutes into the game. He played a total of 14 minutes. Drake and Indiana State both have 4 conference games remaining. The Bulldogs' upcoming opponents have a combined 59-49 record overall and 31-33 in the Valley. The Sycamores' upcoming opponents are 42-66 and 19-45. Quote, "We know the conference schedule is a grind," Tucker DeVries said. He goes on to say, "My first 2 years, we finished second, just a game short. I know our attention to detail for every matchup, taking them one game at a time, and it's at a very high level right now," end quote. Doug?
Before we move on to Dear Abby, here's what's on TV, sports on TV. College baseball, if you want to see that, today, 8:30, Pac-12 end, Kansas State at Arizona State. And college basketball, the men's at 6:30, FS1, Butler at Villanova. At 7 p.m., it's Boston College at Florida State on ACCN, CBSSN, VCU at UMass, Arkansas at Texas A&M on ESPN, Syracuse at North Carolina State, ESPN2, this is at 7 p.m. also, Central Florida at West Virginia, ESPNU, sure are a lot of stations. Peacock, Iowa at Michigan State. If you want to watch Iowa at Michigan State tonight, it's Peacock, and it's here the game. It's at 6:30 p.m. 8:30 p.m. is FS1, UConn at Creighton. 9 p.m. you can go to Pittsburgh at Wake Forest, ACCN. And let's see, San Jose, 10:30 p.m., FS1 at Boise State. It continues on, and there's even some soccer. If you like the soccer, soccer men's, 2:30 p.m. today, USA Premier League, Bretenworth at Manchester City. So I think I'll just call it quits and move on into, before I go to the Dear Abby, here's a brief comment about this. Clark, arguably the best player in history, South Carolina coach Dawn Staley is one of the leading voices of women's basketball, and she offered some of the highest praise to Iowa superstar Caitlin Clark on Friday. Staley, the two-time national championship coach and six-time WNBA All-Star, called Clark, who recently broke the NCAA's Women Division I all-time career scoring record, perhaps the greatest player in the history of the sport. And the six-foot guard leads the country in points per game, 32.8, and assists per game, 8.5 this season. She now sits at 3,569 career points, more than Plum's 3,527. And I'll just go right into Dear Abby now, and its heading is Disease Prognosis Doesn't Dampen Enjoyment of Life. Dear Abby was recently diagnosed with a progressive disease for which there is no cure. It will affect me physically and mentally as I age. For now, I'm treating the symptoms and trying to minimize their effect on my day-to-day life, but this is certainly not how I expected to live out my golden years. I have shared my diagnosis with close family and friends, but until my symptoms become more pronounced, I'm choosing to move forward in a positive way as possible without dwelling on the inevitable health issues that lie ahead. The problem is, some of these friends and family members continually quiz me on the status of my condition. I don't believe I'm in denial, but I choose not to speak or think about my illness every minute of the good days I still have. This disease will take over much of my future soon enough. When voicing these thoughts in response to their queries, I have been met with surprise, and it's perceived as insulting by others who are showing concern for me. How do I convey my desire for privacy regarding my health without offending well-wishers? This problem is sure to become more frequent as the disease progression becomes evident to more people. Good for Now in Michigan is how it's signed. Dear Good, too many people are endlessly curious. If you prefer to take each good day as it comes and not dwell on or be quizzed about your illness, that should be your privilege. You have a right to some privacy. Ask these well-meaning individuals to please not discuss your illness further, because when you are ready to discuss it, you will raise the subject. If that message offends anyone, so be it. Dear Abby, my boyfriend just started his first year of college. We have been together for about a year and a half. He isn't super far away, but his mom is restricting us from seeing each other too often. Every time I go to visit him, I pay for my own train ticket. I don't really think my visiting him is affecting her in any way. We both want to be respectful of her and her wishes, but when it's possible to see him, I'd like to be able to. A relationship is hard to maintain, seeing each other only once a month. He does come home for breaks and some weekends, which I am grateful for. I just don't feel she should be making those choices for us. I want to communicate to her about this, but I don't want to seem disrespectful or rude. What should I do? Three is a crowd, she signed it. Well, dear Three, your boyfriend's mother wants to be sure her son concentrates on his education with as few distractions as possible. She may also be fearful that the two of you are becoming intimate before you are mature enough to manage the consequences. If you're smart, you will refrain from having the discussion you are contemplating. If the visitation schedule is too restrictive, your boyfriend is the person who should talk to his mother about it. Scott?
That brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today, Tuesday, February the 20th, 2024. I'm Scott Splavik, and my partner at the microphone has been Doug Kretzinger. Earlier, you heard Deanna Snyder and Nicole Tam. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.